It is recording, and we're doing Luke chapter 1. Don't let that make you stop making comments or asking a question, please. That would be bad. But Luke chapter 1, I'm turning there myself. We kind of opened up the introduction to Luke last week, and we mainly just focused on the reason for four Gospels, that kind of thing. And we'll kind of going back over verse 1 a little bit. In this it says, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught." And that's the introduction to Luke. And point number one is he wanted to compile a narrative that is orderly. And that's what we see here. And what has been suggested is that this orderly account was actually a one-volume work that the early church split into two and now appears in our canon as two separate works. The Gospel of Luke, contained to the life of Christ, and the Acts of the Apostles. And this is the reason why he doesn't, in the opening of Acts, call him most excellent Theophilus again. He just simply says Theophilus. It's because by addressing him the second time would have been the point of shifting. Christ has now ascended. Theophilus, let's now focus on this. When Christ ascended, so then we see in Luke 24 the ascension of Christ. And again in Acts 1, we see the ascension of Christ. That's the natural transition point. He ascended. That's the end of the life of Christ, so to speak, on earth. He ascends again. Or is my opening, I'm going to say, okay, now I'm going to pick up. When Christ ascended, he left these commands to his guys, and here's how they carried them out. Here's how Paul gets involved, and I'm going to take you to Paul's imprisonment. Because now you're up to date. And it's one massively continuous volume of work. That is one theory. The other theory is that they're two quick ordered letters. I wrote it, one, I gave it to you, and while you're reading that one, a week later, here comes the second one. Kind of scenario. Very close in order, very close in dating. The other theory is that Luke has three separate books. And I have never been a huge fan of Luke as the author of Hebrews until I started the study of Luke. And now I'm almost convinced that Luke is the author of Hebrews because of the massive amount of themes that are being portrayed and paralleled in Luke, Acts, and Hebrews. So that's a theory. Just to kind of give you those things. Now the idea of this is, who is Theophilus? This guy is one of the most debated guys around because of his name. This is literally the meaning of his name. It comes from two root words, theo for God, and philos or philo for love. Or, more importantly, the friend type of love, from which we get the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, which kind of goes with Revelation today. So the city of brotherly love, you know, the city of Philadelphia that the letter was written to was a city that was founded by a king for his younger brother, so his younger brother could be a king also. And that's why it was called the city of brotherly love. He actually broke a portion of his kingdom apart and established a city-state kingdom for his brother. And it was, you know, an act of brotherly love. So we get this concept of a friend of God, and he gets a lot of different theories on this. John Wesley adapted the Coptic view of who this guy was, And they said that he was just a good guy, well known in Alexandria. You know, just this Jew in Alexandria. Others said that he was a Roman official, and that's because he used the Greek word optima, or prime one, or as translated, most excellent. This guy, he was, you know, some kind of official. Many believe that that official would have been able to have a judicial influence in the trials of Paul. Another one is that he's a Roman lawyer. This is mainly built upon this introduction, where he uses the words eyewitness, orderly account, careful investigation, these things that you would expect to find in a legal brief. Another big one is the parallel between the trials of Christ and the trials of Paul. Both of them appeared before an official Roman judiciary official three times. Paul, various Roman officials. Christ, Pontius Pilate. Both were pronounced innocent each and every time, and yet both were still under arrest, both were still under persecution. So, you know, he's trying to draw that parallel. Pilate couldn't find anything wrong with Christ, but he crucified him because he was trying to keep order and peace in the province. Paul, likewise, has not been found guilty by any Roman officials, but why is he under arrest? To keep peace in the province. Because he was arrested in the middle of a riot. Because of a false accusation against him in his presence in the temple. And they put these things together, and that's why they say Theophilus must have been a Roman lawyer. Another one is, it's for anybody. You, me, anyone who would consider themselves a
friend of God.
Or if you want to become a friend of God. That was a little more harder to accept. It's a great extrapolation. You know, we could definitely make that application to us today. As friends of God, or people who consider ourselves to be friends of God, we should know about the life of Christ. And we should have a certainty about the things that we are being taught.
Because you can take out Theophilus' name and just put your name.
Yeah, absolutely. You could.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's kind of the one thing about it, and that's why it's become a huge Christian tradition in this, is saying, well, he was writing to encode to all the Christians who were under persecution, so that they couldn't point to any one in particular to snatch them up and persecute them in a very particular way, a.k.a. death. You know, that type of thing. But as late as the 1800s, some guys began to do archaeology, and they began to find archaeological discoveries, which has led to another theory that today is taking more and more root. But has not gained over a lot of time. One of the leading guys that writes about this is a guy named Allen, and he writes a book about Hebrews being written by Luke. He draws a lot of the parallels that are seen, and he himself also addresses the possibility that Theophilus is an actual guy, and he was a high priest in Judaism. And this comes from the idea that we have two guys with Theophilus connected to their name. The first is Theophilus ben Annas, who was high priest from 37 AD to 41 AD, much prior to the imprisonment of Paul. In the reason why, you know, Theophilus ben Annas is the Annas of Annas and Caiaphas, the high priest of Israel, at the time of Christ's persecution and crucifixion. Caiaphas was the hereditary high priest. He's the father-in-law of Annas. He is the hereditary high priest. And because, remember, when the Levitical priesthood, the high priest was to go as a descendant from Aaron and stay a descendant of Aaron directly. Not Aaron's brothers, not Aaron's first, not his second-born, third-born, that type of thing. Eventually, it was supposed to be like the first-born passage, much like the right of a king. So we have, you know, the priest and the king both having these massive birthright pieces that have to be tied in. So, Ben-Annas literally means the son of Annas. So, Theophilus Ben-Annas would have been the son of Annas, but Annas is the legal high priest at the time that Christ was crucified, because they had begun a practice in which they could gather the alms, skim off the alms, collect enough money to purchase and make the Romans then do political appointments of the high priest. Because the Romans were very much in favor of this, because they wanted to break the power of the hereditary hold so that they could influence the high priest and the Sanhedrin towards Roman favor, because they were tired of dealing with these hard-headed religious Jews who would not be tolerant of other religions. And they thought by political appointment they could leverage some of that. Remember, I kind of put you in office. Type of thing. But either way, if it is Theophilus Ben-Annas, you have to recognize that he would have been raised in the temple. He would have been raised as a student of the Sanhedrin. He would have been raised a Sadducee, which becomes a huge important theme throughout the entire book of Luke. And some of the details I'm going to highlight, not get into here in just a moment, so you can have them. But there's themes that we'll have to identify when they come up and address them as they come up over and over and over again. The other is that he is that it is Mattathias ben Theophilus, who was the high priest from 65 to 67 A.D. And that means he's a descendant of Theophilus. And you say, well, then why would he call him Theophilus and not Mattathias? I mean, that's a natural question. Why did he call him Caiaphas and not Joseph? Because the Caiaphas high priest of hereditary right is actually Joseph ben Caiaphas. And oftentimes in rabbinical tradition, am I pronouncing that right? In the rabbinical traditions, and even in the Greek traditions, which Luke would have been very familiar with, thus the Romans had adopted this tradition as well, oftentimes a student who was just emerging as their own leader until they had a pupil of renown would be identified by their mentor's name. Like Plato wrote, but all of Plato's writings are as Socrates taught. But the truth is, they were actually from Plato's mind. And that was a massive tradition. This is why they would say, you've heard it said, the rabbis say this, but I say unto you, was such a miraculous and mind-blowing thing for Christ to do. Because they would often identify themselves to a rabbi or even another generation of rabbi before them, and thus they would be known by that person's name, because basically they are that person until they replicate themselves in a generation to come. So Caiaphas is not Joseph ben Caiaphas, he's Caiaphas. And Theophilus may not have been Mattathias ben Theophilus, but Theophilus. So those are some of the kind of traditions. And again, his dating of being high priest would have corresponded well with the imprisonment of Paul. Truth is, we really still don't know definitively, but we do know, and somebody has suggested this, well, even if it isn't those high priests, it could be that he wrote it in a kind of tongue-in-cheek manner to the Sadducees in general, to the Levitical priesthood in general. Because when you begin to think that Luke is the author of Hebrews, and you begin to see some serious carryovers and things moving down the line, this is the kind of stuff you get to see. Levitical and Sadducee themes in the book of Luke. Zacharias, the righteous priest of Levitical priesthood, but under controversy. And we'll talk about that in a moment, provided we have time. Mary's purification, which is a religious Levitical ceremony. And then Jesus' temple presentation in combination with that. And Jesus' temple presentation was a simple fact that the firstborn was to be dedicated as a priest to the family. So the first one that opens the womb kind of thing. So there's a Levitical law process that's coming into this. And that's very critical when you move over into Hebrews and you have Christ as a fulfillment of the priesthood of Melchizedek, the king priest. Very important to this in understanding, too, is Elizabeth is a relative of who?
Mary.
So that means Mary had to be a relative of what tribe?
Levite,
yet she's a part of Judah. By descent, she's a part of Judah, but that means somebody in her family is close enough relative, possibly a mother, like her mother, would have been a Levite married to the tribe of Judah, to have Mary be a member of the tribe of Judah. But there had to be some close connection here.
We know that Joseph is a tribe of Judah from Benjamin.
Yes.
That doesn't necessarily mean that Mary is from the tribe of Benjamin, just that Joseph is, because he has to go to his hometown for the census.
So, and this whole thing, he keeps tying in and tying back and all these different pieces to this. So then we get into this. Jesus' bar mitzvah. 12 years old in the temple. Fulfilling the rites of investigation by the priest to determine whether or not he could be accepted into the study for the priestly law.
To be a rabbi.
Dave did a good point of that at the men's retreat Friday morning. Yeah, Friday morning, if you want to catch it on sermon audio. A good historical piece to that. The resurrection and ascension is very, very emphasized over the crucifixion itself. Thus, the ultimate high priest going to intercede. Then you have all these different Sadducee views that Christ himself tackled. Their view on divorce and whether or not it was right. Their view on how angels operated. Not the existence of angels, but the purpose of angels and the methods of angels. Because they would have held to some belief in the angels, or at least recognized it to some point, but what they did definitively deny is the afterlife. So Christ takes on that. The idea of whose wife is she in the... You know, been married to 7 brothers. Whose wife is she?
Yeah.
You know, when they all die childless. The parable against the wicked priests that are seen in the book of Luke. You know, he has the Good Samaritan, which is an attack against the priesthood. The unjust steward, attack against the priesthood. The rich man and Lazarus. The wicked tenants. The control of almsgiving. Because remember, Annas purchased his. It had become a purchasable position. So all of this is given, and then we get the idea of why is this even written, so that we would have certainty of the things that were taught. So now we get into really digging in. So here we go. In the days of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah of the division of Abiah, and he had a wife from the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. Easy enough. Verse 5. Who is Herod? Herod the Great. Okay, so I'm going to give you a little rundown on the history of Herod. He was born in 73 BC and he died in 4 BC. Now, this is critical to us. This is critical to us. Because when is Christ born?
Under Herod.
Under Herod.
Yeah.
So if Herod dies in 4 B.C., Christ can't be born in 0 year.
Right.
So our division of B.C., A.D., or as the new way of doing things, B.C.E.,
yep,
is not accurate. Before the common era, because they can't say before, because they can't say before Christ.
Jeez.
Yeah, you'll see that in all history books have been transferred to that now. And if you do any internet research, you'll see BCE all the time. So he is born to Antipater. Antipater? Yeah. A-N-T-I-P-A-T-E-R. Y'all help me out with that one. An Edomite. Now, the Edomites were descendants of Esau. So they are sons of Abraham. But the Edomites were a branch of the descendants of Esau who converted to Judaism and became practitioners of Judaism in the 2nd century B.C. So here we have a guy who will become the king of Israel for all intents and purposes. And he is by birth not an Israelite, but by raised practice and tradition of religion, for the most part, an Israelite. We're not going to say he's devout, because his lifestyle would not be that of a devout Israelite, but there he is. So how does this guy, an Edomite, come to the throne when the Jewish people are actually looking for their Messiah, a descendant of David, of a particular family from the tribe of Judah? How do we get there? Well, Pompey, of Rome invades the region in 63 BC, and Herod's dad supports him. He becomes a leading supporter of him. He had some wealth, he had some ways of doing this, some influence, and he gets the people of Media to be behind, which is another region of the Israel-Palestinian region that were around. Christ even has a special Immudian ministry section. I think it's in the book of John. That's really where it's captured the most in the Gospels. But Herod gets a chance to go to Rome with Antipater, and he meets Mark Antony in 57 B.C., and they become lifelong friends. I mean, really lifelong friends, like to Antony's death. Lifelong friends. Julius Caesar declares Antipater the procurator of Judea in 47 B.C. and grants Roman citizenship, which now will make Herod a Roman citizen. During the Civil War in Palestine from 40 to 37 B.C., Herod flees the region and goes to Rome. Because Antony and his friend, who's a minister of Caesar by the name of Agrippa, for which he would name one child and a grandchild would be named after, get influence and get Herod a visit before the Roman Senate. And the Roman Senate declare him the king of Israel, or the king of Judea, and they actually make it a political appointment and give him a Roman army to go back and conquer and end the Civil War, so he does. He takes that same army and that same influence and sides with Antony when Octavius or Augustus Caesar and Antony have a dispute, despite Antony taking one of his wives from him or one of his mistresses from him, Cleopatra.
Right.
Who also stole lands from him and gave them to Antony in the time frame. His friendship to Antony was still so great that he stayed with Antony. And when Antony was killed in 31 B.C., Augustus thought the loyalty and the transparency. He said, yes, I sided with Antony. I confess that to you, Augustus. But he thought that his control of the region, his influence of the region, and his loyalty to his friend could be transferred to Augustus himself if Augustus was gracious to him, because he saw the region as a hotbed and he wanted to have the peace of it. So he made a very pragmatic decision and he reinforced Herod as king of Judea and even expanded his empire twice in 20 and 22 BC. And would have given him another region later if Herod had not begun to show signs of slipping into insanity. So let's talk about the signs of insanity. The signs of insanity. He was known for killing his wives if he thought his wives were influencing the sons to threaten the throne. Not only did he kill his wife, though, a couple of them, he killed his wives, their parents, their grandparents, all their relatives that were connected to him, and the children, his sons, as well. So much so that Augustus said it's safer to be a pig in Herod's court than to be a son. And his acts of madness to protect his power were so great that when he ordered the execution of all the toddlers and infants in Bethlehem in 4 BC, shortly before his death, it was not out of order for his mentality. In fact, it was so well known, that's why in Matthew it says, when the wise men showed up, all of Jerusalem was troubled. Because they didn't know what kind of killing spree he was going to go on to find this supposed king of the Jews, because he's the king of the Jews. So that kind of gives you the ideas of when it says, in the days of Herod, we're not just in the days of Herod as in anywhere in his lifetime. We're in the days of Herod when Herod has slipped deep into insanity and he's ravaged by pain. It was said that he was so ravaged by pain of an unknown origin that his insides felt like they were being eaten out. And it kind of makes you think about Agrippa later, his grandson, taking the glory of God from it, that he himself tried to commit suicide and fall on his own sword, and they actually stopped him from doing it, so his suicide attempt was unsuccessful. And he just eventually died being ravaged in pains in the city of Caesarea Maritima, which he set up, which is another reason why they believe in Theophilus going to the Herod court of Maritima would be a connection point. So we have that. Last week we covered Zechariah and Elizabeth's names, meaning Zechariah meaning God remembers and Elizabeth meaning his promises, so that together they are God remembers his promises. So now let's look at Zechariah himself. He is of the order of Abiah. And Abiah, this idea of the order of Abiah is that David recognized when he decided that he wanted to build a temple. And God said, no, you cannot, because you have blood on your hands. You're a man of war. Your son can do that. David went ahead and said, well, I'm going to set my son up for success. He ordered all the building materials to be brought in. He had all the trees being brought in, the lumber brought in, the stones brought in, the gold being prepared. He had everything being done to include saying, there's so many Levites that are among us. And we have to remember now, the Levites were a tribe of Israel, but they were a tribe that had inheritance among all the tribes of Israel, because God had ordained that the priest should be within every tribal city to ensure the tribal city remembered to worship God. So that's their kind of just intermixed all over the place, but they would come together for the huge ceremonial rites and the festivals and everything else. And David said, there's so many of them that they all can't serve God. Because remember, the service of God is tied to one location. It's not like today, where any one of us could decide to serve God on any given Sunday in any manner of way throughout. And it's sad because so many people don't when compared to this system that had to be put into place. But they divide them up into divisions. 24 divisions of priests. Abiah is the 8th order. And the 24 divisions would serve for 8 days through one Sabbath. So they would get their particular pieces of order by the casting of lots. The plural. So we have this kind of done. And if you want to see about where David established the
the 24 orders. It's 1 Chronicles 24, 4 through 6, and verse 10 gives Abiah as the 8th in particular. Another point that we want to make about being a Levite is, remember, Moses was a Levite, and of course we talked about Aaron and the direct descendancy of the high priest. So we have this idea of them being determined by lot. Now, before we get into what Zechariah was doing, which was determined by lot, I want to give this other thought to you on Elizabeth and Zechariah being childless. Maybe this is why God led us to Job in our previous study, and it moved us here, is because it really floored me as I was praying and looking over this, as they're both identified as righteous. They are both righteous in commandment and statutes. So, and I got to think, is there a difference between commandments and statutes? And there is. Righteous and statutes both come from the same root word, which means to be right. So, in other words, the statutes aren't necessarily the Mosaic law. They're any societal order type of piece to include Roman law that would have been considered right for the establishment of civility. So, in regards to those, they were righteous. And in regards to the Mosaic law, which is the commandments, they were righteous by God's decree before God. Well, so was Job. But here's the deal. To understand this, we need to look back at something. Elizabeth is barren. Mm-hmm. And in Genesis chapter 30, we see Rachel in verses 1 and 2 having conversation with Isaac. And she says to him, "Give me children lest I die." And he says, "Who am I? Am I God that I can open your womb?"
Yeah.
I don't know why God has closed your womb. It's not my fault.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? So then later when Joseph is born, in verses 23 and 24 of Genesis chapter 30, she says, "God has removed my reproach." Mm-hmm. Barren women were considered to be reproached by God. God was withholding children from them because they had done something that was not righteous.
Yes.
Hannah, 1 Samuel, they said that she must not have been righteous. The priest, in seeing her praying, thought she's drunk because everything else, she can't be right and everything else. And yet she's there praying for a child because she knows she's looked on as lesser of a woman. She has a reproach. God has cursed her in some way, and she's begging to have the curse lifted, the child, a child be born to her, and everything else. But what happens and we know she gets Samuel, but what would have happened if she had prayed like Elizabeth to the point of being barren past age? Mm-hmm. Or past the ability to have children, past menopause? Mm-hmm. That's Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. And that's why I say, is this a case of Job? Like, okay, here, God is going to say, "I'm going to prove to you that these people are still righteous, and my judgment is the true judgment, and I'm going to do it in two ways. One, she's going to have a miraculous child, who's the forerunner of Christ." We'll get to that. But the very first thing he does is by the Purim, the casting of lots. It falls on Zechariah, possibly cursed by God according to society's eyes, can't have children. What did him and his wife do wrong?
Yeah.
To have the absolute highest job that the Levite priest, who was not a high priest, could perform in the temple. The lighting of the altar of incense. And here's the deal. You could only do it once in your entire life because all the priests had to be given a chance to do it. Why did it not fall on him when there was still of an age to have children? Because it wouldn't have been miraculous. In fact, it would have drawn a sharp contrast between a guy who, though he's a Levite, is truly right with God and the rest of the Levites. Keeping with the possible theme
that Luke is trying to establish to whoever Theophilus is, right out the gate.
What is the casting of the lots? I'm trying to.
It's a Purim. It's like a dice.
So oh, a dice.
Read Esther.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's where Purim comes from, is the book of Esther.
In the idea, okay. In the idea of they had the Umum Thurim, but the Purim is the idea of Esther was chosen by lot to be with the king this night in her beauty contest. Yeah.
And so they establish a feast of Purim.
In the first Bachelor at episode.
Oh, thank you, Roger.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Got it. Yeah. But are they really dice? It's not dice.
Yeah, yeah. It was ancient season one.
We don't know exactly what it was.
It's more like a white stone. They would have like different colored stones and maybe pull the white stone out. Some said sometimes it was they went to cubes that had certain markings. Mm. Y'all have seen Star Wars Phantom Menace kind of deal where they had the blue and the red cube and they rolled it and based upon the color that came up.
Yeah. So what happens to Jonah in the boat?
Yeah, they cast in lots.
Who was at fault for this giant storm and they all cast lots? It goes to Jonah. We don't. There's several
options.
Just
like drawing straws.
Yeah.
Like
kind of like short straw.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. But yeah. There's a divine nature.
But they trusted that God, that as it came out, God was the one who identified this. Remember, the person who took Judas Iscariot's place also was done by lot.
Yeah.
Thus, God said, this is the guy who's supposed to be the apostle.
And the Romans cast lot for Christ's cloak.
Yep. Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah. So the lot was a huge thing back then.
Okay.
So let's go to verses 8 and 10 real fast. Now, while he was serving as priest before God, when his division was on duty, according to the custom of the priesthood, he was chosen by lot to enter the temple of the Lord and burn incense. We got that. We talked about that. Now, watch. And the whole multitude of the people were praying outside at the hour of incense, and there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And Zechariah was troubled when he saw him, and fear fell upon him. So let's just stop right there. I have a picture right up here of the temple.
Yeah.
And of course, this chamber up here would have been the Holy of Holies. The Holy of Holies. This is where, if the Ark was in Jerusalem, would have been. But the Ark has not been seen since the first Babylonian, or since the first deportment of the Babylonian captivity. And what's strange is it says all the furniture and all the spoons and all the every instrument of it, the super crazy inventory detail carried to Babylon, carried back to Israel. The Ark is neither carried away nor is it brought back. Thus, Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark and all the other things that we have now about what happened to the Ark kind of deal. So the Ark of the Covenant isn't even here. Remember, the Ark of the Covenant is the seat of the Shekinah glory, the presence of God. So how long has the presence of God been removed from these people? In its fullest sense, other than operating through his prophets.
And who was going to touch it? Because it was falling. Someone touched it and died.
Yes, but we're in this concept of 400 years of not even having a prophet.
That's right. Silence.
We're in the silence. John's not born yet. So we're having this peace here. So, but what they do have is they still have the candlestick on the right, the table of showbread on the left, and the altar of incense directly forward. So this X right here represents, right before the altar of incense, the box of altar of incense I drew, represents Zechariah. Now I have two X's, one to the left and one to the right of the altar. We have to go back to rabbinical teachings and rabbinical traditions to understand this. The altar of incense is there, okay? And the left hand towards the table of showbread is reserved for Gabriel, the archangel messenger of God. Okay? The right side is reserved for God himself. Now I have Exodus 33 verse 20 written on the board where God says to Moses, "You cannot see my face and live."
Okay.
So I'm going to hide you in a rock, in the cleft of a rock, and I'll pass by and let you see my backside. Right? That's the story. Now, these guys know what Moses wrote. Because what did Dave teach us? By the time they were 5 years old, they had... Five to 9 years old, they had to memorize the entire Torah.
Yeah.
The first five books of Moses. Then by the age of 10 to 14, the bar mitzvah time frame,
yes,
they had to memorize the rest of the New Testament, or the Old Testament. So a Jewish boy by the time of 14 years of age had memorized the entire Old Testament. Now, combined with this, the rabbinical teachings, and we can't even give, we have to give them flashcards for math formulas.
Right, I was just going to say, and they can't even figure out how to do their homework now.
So you have this altar of incense, and this rabbinical teaching that this is God's place, and did you notice in the passage where it said Gabriel showed up? On the right side of the altar. Gabriel showed up and said, I'm going to show you how wrong your Levitical priesthood has been, even in teaching about the things of God. I'm going to show up right where God should be standing, but I'm Gabriel on the wrong side. But it's no wonder that great fear fell on Zechariah, because all of a sudden there's a divine being standing there, this supernatural being, maybe not divine being is not the right word, the supernatural being, this angelic being. He thinks he just saw the face of
God.
I'm sure.
God be scared too. I'm just saying.
Yeah. All right, so next week we'll talk about what he says to him. So we'll go to prayer.